On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2007 opened with a burst of American women in the spotlight. Oprah, flanked by Mariah Carey, Tina Turner, and Mary J. Blige, ladling out millions for young girls in Africa, saying, "The future is so bright for them, it burns my eyes." Nancy Pelosi, grandchildren at her side, lifting the gavel as the first female Speaker of the House, celebrating a remarkable first in American history. But overall, even now, women make up just 16% of the U.S. Congress, and globally, in a world of conflict, women are still, starkly, the second sex when it comes to power. Would it be different if they weren't? Up next on Point, a global roundtable of women in the thick of it on women and power. Joining me in the studio today are three female political leaders from afar, Sudan, Iraq, and Nepal. Also with us, Swanee Hunt, former ambassador to Austria and director of the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's JFK School of Government. She's also chair of the Initiative for Inclusive Security, which advocates the full participation of women in conflict resolution. This week and next, she's hosting a conference in Boston and Washington with women leaders from around the world, including those in our studio today, to talk about how to grow women's participation in government. Swanee Hunt, thanks for being with us. Ambassador Hunt.
Thank you.
And let me introduce the rest of our panel, and I'm so thrilled to have this opportunity. With us from Sudan, Betty Oguaro, member of the parliament in the government of Southern Sudan, president of the Southern Sudanese Women Parliamentarian League, and chair of the Southern Sudanese Women's Caucus. Betty Oguaro, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
With us from Nepal, Sarita Giri, central committee member of the Nepal Sabawana Party, the Good Will Party. She's founder of the Center for Women in Politics, which is bringing together a coalition of eight political party women leaders in Nepal to try to create a new egalitarian democracy there. Sarita Giri, thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you. And with us, Mishkat Al-Mumin. She's former Minister of the Environment in the interim government of Iraq, 2004 to 2005, now a visiting scholar, Futrell visiting scholar at the Environmental Law Institute in Washington, D.C., founder of the Women in Environment Organization in Iraq. Mishkat Al-Mumin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, so let's step back. Ambassador Hunt, just for a moment here, there was Nancy Pelosi last week, and it was quite a moment. All the kids and grandkids around her, a woman with the gavel in the House of Representatives for the first time. You know, whatever party you're in, you had to take note of that. I watched that moment with my 12-year-old daughter, and I have to say the hair stood up on the back of my neck. This is something new when you think about our sisters and our daughters and the horizon that they can factually look at there as open to them. When you look overall, though, around the world and in the United States, how do you assess the standing of women's real power in politics and government, where the levers are these days?
It was so interesting listening to the media talking about this election and how, you know, this is the year of the woman. And then you step back, and in addition to loving that view of Nancy Pelosi, you look at the stats and you say, oh, we went from 14% to 16% in the Congress.
Right.
I mean, come on, give me a break.
It's not exactly 50%.
That's right. A different way to say it is the U.S. Congress now is 84% men, and that has a different feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
We are not a world leader. The U.S. is not.
In women's stepping to the fore in power?
In women's participation, we are 66th in the world. And that's because there are about 90 countries that have some kind of seats that are actually reserved for women.
Constitutionally or legally.
That's mm-hmm. right. In mm-hmm. one way or another, they mm-hmm. have a quota. But we're allergic to quotas in the U.S., so we're mm-hmm. not going to get there. But this conference is bringing women from conflict areas, and that's the very interesting sliver here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about what can women do in political leadership. It's in conflict areas where you have, for example, in Nepal, 13,000 people who've been killed in this insurgency.
The Maoist insurgency.
That's
there.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Or in Sudan, where you're talking about 4 million people who've been killed over these years and 4 million displaced, you know, mm. having to flee mm. their homes. Or we all know the Iraq situation. What can women do? Is there something women do that's different from what men can do?
Conflicts in many countries, conflicts of all kinds in this country, though not on that scale. But here we have armed conflicts represented in this room. And I want to turn to our panelists, but what's your sort of 30,000 feet perspective on this? Does it make a difference? When conflict is on the table, if women are richly represented at the table,
we know that it makes a difference. And it makes a difference partly because women are very relationship-oriented, and they find ways to not simply be stuck in their identity in a political party or in one side of a conflict, but they work women to women across. And we have examples all over the world of women creating these coalitions to stop a conflict.
So not stuck with boundaries or lines or what, chest thumping the way Americans might be, but rather looking at people? Is that a stereotype or is that for real?
You know, stereotypes are often based on an awful lot of fact.
Mm-hmm.
They're dangerous when you try to apply them to individuals. You can always find bellicose women leaders. You can always find great, great men like Gandhi or Nelson Mandela. Mm. But when you look at norms, you'll find that men tend to be more prone to turn to the gun, whereas women tend to be more prone to turn to words.
Let's dive in with our wonderful group of guests here from right around the world. Betty Achan Agwara, let me turn first to you. You're from southern Sudan. There was civil war there just for the very longest time. You were in exile for many years. You've been back for a year or two now and in a position of some power. What difference does it make that you're a woman in that setting?
This is a very important question. Southern Sudan had been in war for a long time, but within that war, women participated very effectively in seeing to it that the armed struggle should be stopped. I was one of the women right from the beginning of the armed struggle that I took up the banner of campaigning for peace, because any conflict cannot be solved by the arms. So during this time, I mobilized women. We went on streets. We asked presidents. We asked leaders to see to it that the war must stop. But we also worked alongside with the men. While men are fighting, we talked to them that the best solution to this is to negotiate on the table. While in exile, I didn't stop just in exile. I used to go to and fro, negotiating with people, asking president. I wrote a letter to President Bush when he came onto power. I said, congratulations, President Bush. But while you are in power, don't forget that in the Sudan, people are not talking about the war in the southern Sudan. So please put it in your agenda, which he did.
Which he did, and peace eventually came. But that war went on for so many years. I mean, women may have been pushing against it, but they did not succeed in all those years in stopping it. You had great kind of powers here, Islam facing the Christianity of the southern Sudan, lots of tension around that. What does it say that in spite of those efforts that you describe, it went on for so long, that women didn't have power, weren't listened to, weren't effective in wielding the power they had? Why?
In the beginning, women themselves shied off. Women were afraid of taking leadership until a group of us, women, took up the training to make women's voice be heard. So women's voice only became heard towards the end. That is why the peace negotiation became more effective. Initially, women were afraid. They thought war and armed conflicts were for men. And if they get involved, they would be killed, their sons would be killed. But until that perspective was changed, and the perspective was only changed when women came into the perspective and told themselves that we need to get in order for this war to stop. So they started effectively campaigning for the war to stop. Without that, this war could have even still be going on.
Mm.
Letters written to President Bush or letters written to other presidents in the world were headed by women. And women like us sat down and said, men, join us. Put your hands together with us, and we send these letters.
Betty Agwara of Southern Sudan, right in the middle of it there. Let me turn to Sarita Giri from Nepal, where, of course, there's been plenty of trouble. The Maoist insurgency, their trouble with the democracy and the monarchy. As I read up on you, your experience may have been slightly different. This Maoist insurgency was not without women fighting right in the middle of it. I mean, do you see women as necessarily pushing a culture closer to peace, or are they just as likely to be combatants?
Women's involvement in this Maoist insurgency has opened new, you know, so many new areas that has to be explored. But one thing that we all more or less have come to agree about is that even if women have, you know, raised guns, siding with the Maoists, that is basically for bringing change, positive change in the society and in politics. You know, the rural women who have mostly participated or sided with the Maoist, in fact, they were not very much aware of the Maoist ideology, of the communist ideology. Mm-hmm. But since the democratic regime, which was established in 1990, that could not deliver much, that could not connect with the women into the rural parts.
So they were dissatisfied with their reality, never mind ideology for a minute.
Yes, yes. That is what that we understand. They were dissatisfied with the reality, and so Maoist movement that appeared to them as an alternative movement. And so somehow, maybe because of lack of awareness, lack of knowledge and lack of other alternatives, you know, like somehow I would like to say that they joined this Maoist militia also under some kind of pressure also.
Pressure, including the pressure of their families' daily lives and their dissatisfaction with that. But there they were in the swirl of insurgency. We're talking this hour with women from combat zones, conflict zones around the world, about women in power, the obstacles to getting there, and the difference they make when they are there, about women and power. Right now, I want to hear from Mishkat Al-Mumin, former Minister of the Environment in the interim Iraqi government, 2004-2005. Talk about a zone of conflict. You couldn't have been more deeply in one. What about women in Iraq right now? Are they making a difference as a gender, or is it so chaotic and violent that they're, you know, just trying to stay alive?
I think there's always will be a chance for women to participate in public life, in ordinary life. And getting back to your question, what's the difference? Women always put their hands on the pulse of the society, and that's that very important. To stabilize the country, it's not only about law and orders and more troops and stuff like that. It's about providing public services. It's about having enough water. It's about having enough energy. It's about going to school. It's about having health services. To give you a more practical example, or actually a real story, I think all of our audience heard of Al-Sadr City. Mm-hmm. Al-Sadr City, it's a very conservative area, one of the hotspot areas in Iraq.
Shiite area of Baghdad.
Shia-dominated area, yet with a small fraction of Sunni. I don't think the audience would know that. The city is badly planned, no public services. Baghdad, it's very, very hot. It's a desertic climate, severely hot. That was in summer 2004. Reports came to my office saying that they are facing severe shortage of water. There were no way that we can pump more water because all the pipelines were damaged. We decided to run a campaign to distribute water all over the city. And that was ongoing through the summer. We involved local communities, community leaders, local NGO. And we managed to save the city from a very severe humanitarian disaster situation. The city cooperated with us. Can you believe that such a conservative city will allow the ministry to train the female and the male teacher on how to teach environmental issues to their students?
But here's the question, and let me ask you, is that you're all from conflict zones, Iraq perhaps most of all right now. Is there a point at which a conflict, in a conflict zone, things just float out of the hands or out of the reach of women? You provided water in that summer. Bless you for it, and I'm sure it brought relief to a lot of people. But Iraq has just gotten worse and worse since then. Is it now somehow out of the hands of women? Would it make a difference if you could get a handle on it? I mean, what difference are women making in Iraq today? Is it
Let
too
me
chaotic?
Give you another story that I witnessed in my own eyes. In 2003, around August, one of the militias issued a statement saying everyone who will go to work on that day will be killed. And I was one of the people who went to work on that day. Believe it or not, I saw millions of women on my way to work, standing in the street. Some of them were doctors, physicians, having their white coat on, ready to go to work. I saw less men, but I saw a huge amount of women in the street. Women thought that the conflict may lead to injury. And we as doctors, as nurses, as mothers, We need to be there to help those injured people.
To be on the job.
To be on the job.
Biddy Aguaro, with your experience in southern Sudan, what about this question? Is there a point at which the intensity of a conflict becomes so great that the instincts and practical help that women bring to leadership, to their jobs, get sidelined as a major factor, where it's all guns and testosterone?
That is true. On most occasions, women take up the duty even when bullets are still crossing the air. I can tell you that in southern Sudan, where there were so many times that bullets were crossing the air, you will still find women going for water. You will still find nurses going to the hospital. You will still find teachers going to the schools and trying to stop the children from running around the streets so that the bullets don't catch them. But men would sometimes try to hide and take shelter, while women would gather the children and gather the remaining men or even wounded people who are on the way so that they are protected.
You've practiced some direct intervention with the Lord's Resistance Army, mainly across the border in Uganda, helping get negotiations going on there. Tell us that story, if you would, Biddy Aguaro.
That's right. When I came into Parliament, I found myself in a situation where I had to take action, because I was representing a county where the Lord's Resistance Army was very active. So I went to the president and I said, this is the time we have to talk to the Lord's Resistance Army. So I took the opportunity to go up to Garamba, where the Lord's Resistance Army leader, Joseph Kony, was staying. And you might have known that the Lord's Resistance Army is a very brutal group of the army.
Tough on boys and tough on girls. Many kidnapped into a kind of slavery there.
Many children are kidnapped and they're put in the child soldier. Many young girls became young mothers. They cut off lips of women, old people. They cut off ears of people. They make people dig their dead, cook it, and eat the body of
the dead. So how did he, the head of this Lord's Resistance Army, receive you, the woman, from Sudan?
The first time I went to Garamba was in May. Joseph Kony himself did not receive me. But I met his vice, Vincent Oti, and I told Vincent Oti, what you are doing is not acceptable. What if your mother was raped, your sister was raped, your mother's ears and mouths were cut off? How would you feel? I would like to talk to Joseph Kony. And he said he would make that possible if I came back after 21 days. It is a very harsh environment in Garamba. There's no house, there's nowhere, there's no clean water, but I still went back. And we walked 5 kilometers to meet Joseph Kony. And he came and met us. And I told him, Joseph Kony, this must stop. The government of Southern Sudan has offered to be a mediator to negotiate peace between you and the government of Uganda. This is the best chance for you to take it, because no other country would accept negotiating peace between you and the government of Uganda, knowing the history and the things you have done to the community. Number two, the government of Sudan is not a signatory to the ICC, where you are running away from and you are hiding from the ICC. So please take this chance. Because if today your mother who is living in Uganda was raped by any army man, or your mother's lips was cut out by a young boy who she could consider as her son, or your mother was told to eat her own sister who was dead, how would you feel?
Was this man susceptible to this argument from a Sudanese woman, after everything he's seen and ordered?
Joseph Kony said, I beg to apologize for everything that has happened in the name of the Lord's Resistance Army. And I can promise you that I will sit on the negotiating table and negotiate with the government of Uganda. I personally will not come to Juba because I am afraid that I will be arrested by the ICC. But I will empower my team, who will negotiate with the team coming from the
government. So on that day, in that place, a kind of progress there, and good on you for making the trek to make it happen. We have women from around the world with us today. Nepal, Sudan, Iraq, Ambassador Swanee Hunt is with us as well. I want to turn to our callers. Rosemary is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Rosemary, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I just want to make the point that I think definitely women's time has come. And it's probably best illustrated by the rise of Nancy Pelosi in Congress as Speaker of the House. First of all, if you just look at what she's done in the past, she was a promoter of something called the Child Wellness Act several years ago, which is now enforced in all of our public schools that receive public money. And I'm certainly part of this movement, trying to get the junk food out of schools and to get good, nutritious food in schools. Then if you look at simply how she chose to march into Congress, she did it with children, her grandchildren.
In her arms.
Children of other people who worked in the offices. She didn't choose to march in with a bunch of suits or people in military uniforms. This sends a very powerful message to people that this is a person who really wants to work for people, for families.
Only 16% of the seats in Congress held by women, Rosemary. So how can you say women's time has come?
Well, it's a start. It's definitely a start. And any movement that progresses too quickly will probably be short-lived. But something that progresses in a consistent, slower manner, such as I think women's progress in our country has done, is meant to last.
It sounds like you're counting on it, and we thank you for your call. Sarita Giri from Nepal. What about the American profile of women in power? How did you think about it before you came? When you look more closely, when you're here, do women look well represented in American power to you, or shy of the mark?
Coming from Nepal, when we come here, we are really impressed. The American women have made the progress in different areas like academics, in the business world, in social service sector. But their underrepresentation in politics has always been a puzzle to us. But I think in the last decade, positive signs are taking place. And of course, the election of the speaker here, that's again something that we are looking with great hope and optimism. And, the women's progress in America, in politics, that's going to influence us. And not only that, I think the kind of intervention American women in politics are making, that is going to have huge impact, for the lives and for the policy of even developing countries. So when we are here, we are definitely looking up at them with great hope, and we will be looking forward to connect, to having networking with them in future also.
Ambassador Hunt, do you see American, the United States, as progressive on women's power or stick in the mud?
We're pretty far behind, and yet the world looks to us. So I'm really struck with what Sarita said. What we find is that across the world, the higher the percentage of women in a parliament, the more funding goes into health and education and foreign aid. So Sarita, you're right to be hopeful, as particularly as Nancy Pelosi comes into a position with so much influence. But she's got to bring an awful lot of men along too with her.
That's the way it works. Right now, Sarah's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah, you're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I was calling because one of the things I do is teach women in prison, and we discussed the whole problem of women's approach to conflict. We read literature by women about war, and I asked these women what they thought. Would women do things differently? These are women who may have even committed violent crimes, but they insist that women have a very different approach to solving conflict and to preventing conflict and to negotiating, even within their own families. And I was so struck with how women in a situation such as prison can still feel that if women had the power to change things, they would change things.
Sarah, and yet, Sarah, these women were in prison. Something had gone wrong. Is this just women talking a good game, or do you feel confident that if women had the real power, that things would be different society-wide?
Well, I'm very fortunate because I work for a women's peace organization, WAND, and I represent WAND at the United Nations, so I spend a lot of time with some of the women that are on your program, and I know Swanee, and I know the wonderful work that she does. And I think that all around the world, women are recognizing that the war system is no longer something that they can tolerate. And women are changing the war system. We just heard a whole bunch of examples, and I think even women in prison have the right to talk about how they would change the system.
Absolutely, no question. Sarah, thanks for your call. Mishkat Al-Mameen of Iraq, what about it? Women changing the war system. President Bush will speak tonight about Iraq. The war there has been fierce and gotten worse. As an Iraqi, do you feel, for example, do you have any sense of American women reaching out to you through American policy in a way that makes a difference, or does it feel like a male policy on the march?
Well, let me tell you something, Tom. The tears of the mother are all the same. Women do understand each other. It doesn't matter that she's an American woman and I'm an Iraqi woman. We all share the same concerns. We all care about our kids. We all care about hospitals. We all care about education. We all think of public services. Another story that I would like to share with you, maybe to show that women can work through across ethnic and sectarian divisions. As I mentioned before, Al-Sadr City has a small portion of Sunni. So we decided to have something unique to bring the city together, and I mean the ministry.
This was the environment ministry that you headed up.
This was the environmental ministry, exactly 2005. We decided that to speak to the clerics, the Sunni clerics and the Shia clerics, to talk to people in Al-Sadr city and advocate for environment and Islam. The idea was to bring up the peaceful values of Islam rather than the violent ones. Both sides agreed, and that was unique.
But we're told that the Shiites are doing a kind of ethnic cleansing in Baghdad.
You are talking about Shia militia. I'm talking about the Shia people, and there is a difference in between. I'm talking about the average person.
But aren't some of those clerics, in effect, leaders of the militia? Directors?
There are, you can find some that are not involved. And we managed to find them through community leaders, and they were powerful leaders. Both Sunni side, Shia side, spoke to people on the first day of Eid. It's our Easter. And they talked to people about environment as a peaceful value of Islam. Believe it or not, we received so many good feedback later on. And we carried on so many projects based on that. We were welcomed from both sides.
Hassan is calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Hi, Hassan. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on the line. My comment is about women in conflict areas. I think women bring some sort of humane concern to conflict zones. For example, in Liberia, Mrs. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has done tremendous work.
The new Liberian leader who took office a year ago or so.
Exactly. She has done a tremendous job in trying to reconcile a country that was torn apart by many years of war. In the African context, actually, women are viewed as being very harmless in conflict situations. So in this respect, I believe that women have a lot more to achieve.
But does harmless mean ineffectual or inconsequential, Hassan? Or does it mean powerful in a different way?
No, actually, what I'm talking about is men generally view, at least in the African context, women as not being harmful to their cause. For example, in war situation, take for example President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She went to prison under the administration of Samuel Doe. That was between 1980-1989.
In Liberia,
Liberia, and she challenged the Liberian dictator, who's now in jail, President Charles Taylor. And prior to her, the Liberian conflict that had run for many years was actually resolved when a woman became head of the transitional government. She's called Mrs. Ruth Perry.
Hassan, I think I want to hear from the women on this. Swanee Hunt, I think you're just back from Liberia.
I am. I've been there twice in the last year, working with the women members of parliament and civil society leaders, grassroots leaders and the like. And it's fascinating to watch how President Johnson Sirleaf is orchestrating this, because not only is she the first woman elected in Africa, but first woman president, but she has brought in a woman as finance minister, commerce minister, justice minister, and chief of police.
Wow, full house.
That's right. That's right. And she's doing it to cut through the corruption that she inherited.
Let me take a call from Priest River, Idaho. Joe's on the line. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. First, I'd just like to say thank you to all you women. You guys show remarkable courage out there in the face of all this macho men, and I do appreciate it. Two things I wanted to touch on. One is I've always ascribed to the theory that that women should be in charge. I think your conflict resolution tactics are far better than what men can do, and couldn't agree more that we're way more likely to go to the gun. But I do think there needs to be a little male influence, because sometimes when you're dealing with these people, you got, from my point of view, you've got to deal with the gun. And the second thing I'd like to say is I found it kind of disheartening when the lady that was over there in the Sudan talking about what was happening to the women and the children there, the horrible things that happened, and then you got a caller 30 seconds later talking about getting junk food out of the schools. It's just amazing.
Well, every country has its own challenges, I guess. Uganda has some. The United States has different ones. But we hear the thumbs up at the same time, and yet with that proviso that you put on it, Joe, that you still need some men around to reach for that gun. Sarita Geary, how do you hear that? Our earlier caller, Sarah, said maybe women would change the war system. Joe calls and says, you women ought to be in charge, but we still want to have a man around with the gun. Can we have it both ways?
It's very interesting, but I would like to begin with women, how women have changed the rules of the war. I would like to say that how women have changed the rules of conflict as well. Like, you know, in case of Nepal, it's a very interesting story. There is a novel, Palpasa Cafe, which has received the highest, you know, award in Nepal. And that is all about, you know, how women have got involved into Maoist conflict. And it's the story of
how women got into the middle of the Maoist conflict in Nepal.
They sided with the Maoist, you know.
Yes.
They raised the guns.
Became,
you know?
Maoist.
Yeah, they became
the
Maoist, yes. Mm-hmm. And so her life is very difficult. And the father is there. And her father looks at the life of women who are mostly living in Kathmandu, the elite's women having most of the facilities.
Yep.
And when he looks at the life of his own daughter, and then he sees that there's no hope for her, and when the Maoists, they come and they approach her, they request her that you come and join with us. If you join us, if we are going to make this regime defeat,
we'll
then you
change
are going
your
to,
circumstances.
Yes, there's going to be hope. And then the girl, she goes and asks to the father, and the father says, okay, like, if you see that you hold some future with this, I will not stop you. And the girl finally decides to leave the house, but she asks, her brother, that, okay, I'll be there, but I'll come back. Having said that, you know, like, as we were talking with Ambassador Hunt, you know, like, how people say that in Nepal, conflict was aggravated because there was no development. But no. Women, by participating in conflict on both sides, I'll say on the side of peaceful political action and also on the side of, you know, armed insurgency, they have, you know, changed the dynamics and the definition of conflict. It's not the lack of development. It's the lack of right to development that has, you know, transformed the entire scenario. And let me tell you, when Seven Party Alliance, the parliamentary party, when
that you're allied with, yes.
Yeah, when they began the movement, when the king took over the power, then their agenda was, you know, the problem to democracy is king. So let's, eliminate the king's power, and then we can go back to the seat of power, and then we can deal with the Maoist.
Mm-hmm.
The Maoists started with the agenda that, you know, now we need to have a republic. We don't need a king. But the political aim was the seizure of a state power and then imposition of communist state. But you know how women, they changed, women and along with other excluded group, your people.
The female Mao is saying, well, let's not be ideological. If you change the circumstances, we don't have to continue to go for that same goal.
Yes, not only female Maoists, also women on the Seven Party side.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually, you know, they began to join the discourse. On one hand, they are taking part into political activities. Mm-hmm. But then this agenda has come up that the solution of having a solution, I mean, a conflict resolution is state restructuring. Mm-hmm. How are you going to empower people?
But a kind of pragmatism you're pointing there, to reach for the gun if necessary, but to be open to the solution when it's possible, if I hear you correctly.
No, I would like to say that, you know, like, yes, we must accept that if a reason has gone to conflict zones, you know, or entered conflict, that means there are reasons on the ground, like we would like to call it structural violence, you know, the structures which you are not able to change, you know, through regular means, you know. And when it becomes unbearable, then maybe that some people or some women or some excluded group will like to make the use of conflict, but they know very well that how to bring it to a point where it has to be resolved. And this is what that has happened in Nepal.
For the peaceful payoff, and we say, you know, good luck on that front. Let me take a call from Pittsburgh, if I may. David's on the line. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, how are you?
We're very well. What do you think, David?
I'd like to go back for a second to the premise. With all due respect to all the women who are on the panel, and with due respect to women generally, I have three daughters and a wife whom I love dearly, women that I work with. I really have a problem with this premise. I mean, women throughout history as leaders have shown themselves to be as corruptible as men and subject to the same flaws as men and hubris and what have you. Women in positions of leadership in industry have shown themselves to be subject to flaws, really, in many respects, the same as men have been.
And do you think it would be the same, David, if women were equally represented in power? These women are typically there as outliers, not backed up by a majority of women in leadership around them. Would that make any difference or not?
Perhaps it would make some difference. I mean, context is not unimportant, but I mean, the point is, with all the talk that we hear in society about, you know, claims of gender bias and gender differentiation being problematic and detrimental to women, how can we sit here on the other hand and say the women have these traits that make them, you know, as a gender, so much more superior in certain respects to men? I think people are people. I think power corrupts.
David, let's have the women have their say. Ambassador Hunt, what do you say to David in Pittsburgh?
I absolutely agree that power corrupts, but it makes a very big difference if you're the one woman who has climbed up to the top of a hierarchy of men, or if you have a critical mass of 35 or 40% women beneath you. We see very significant differences in corruption. There are four different studies looking at the fact that women are more trustworthy. They don't put the money in a Swiss bank account. They spend it on education and health care for the children.
I'd like to hear among yourselves, Mishkat, Betty, Sarita, what do you think? If women were in charge, would it make a fundamental difference? David says he's skeptical. What do you think?
I agree with one caller before that we need to have a mixed table. We need to have part of women on the table and part of the men. If we have only men ruling the world will not go correct. If we have only women ruling the world will not go correct. But it's very important that both women and men share responsibility in a country, in running the country. That makes a difference. Because where men think of reaching for the gun, women can talk them off and think of a possible solution. So if we have men, well, very few women on the table, the voice of the men can overcome the voice of the women. Power surely corrupts. If you have one woman who has gone up and there's nobody behind her, surely she can think that she's the only woman and she's the strongest, she's equivalent to a man, and she can be corrupt. But if she has the support of other women and she looks around the table and there are other women, they will think of how many schools do we need, how many of our girls are still not in school, what are the roads we need? How much clean water could we advocate for? Mm. So women would think of developmental issues more than think of, can we reach for a gun because somebody is now a president and I should have been in his position.
Mishkat Amlamin, how about it? If Iraq, I mean, it's a giant if, and we could only wish things were different somehow, but if Iraq, if the power there were held 50-50, let's say, men, women, do you think it would be a different country? There'd still be Kurds and Sunni and Shia. There'd still be tension over wealth. There'd still be all the, tensions of history built into this country. Would it be different if women had half the power?
I'm glad you mentioned the Kurds, because when the Kurds get rid of Saddam Hussein earlier, that was after the first Gulf War, 1991, the two Kurdish parties went into conflict with each other. It was simply as that Kurds are killing Kurds, the same ethnicity, the same religion division. They couldn't stop until the women launched a huge march, both sides, both Kurdish sides. There were women. They launched a huge march. They went to the conflict zone asking both parties to put guns down. And until now, the Kurds themselves, they said that we are better off when we had women participating in the government. They have full participation, they have full support, and they managed to put down the guns.
So raising the flag right there, let's get a couple more women from outside this room. Valerie is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Valerie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. You know, I agree. I'm sort of responding to an earlier point. I agree it isn't about, you know, having women per se in leadership, though I sincerely believe women should be equally represented as much as having a feminist or a female point of view. And also, you know, we've been, you know, violence has been with us since the caveman. But, you know, the rocks that we dropped on each other's heads when we were Neanderthals, you know, have grown to nuclear bombs. And, you know, violence just, I just don't see it working. And I really believe that we just have to stop subjugating, you know, our sons, our brothers, our daughters to violence. You know, that it does not work. And I think a different, women do bring a different point of view, but a more feminist point of view is absolutely necessary.
A woman's voice for peace right there. And another call from Sharon in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm in agreement where I believe that women's time is now. And I do think that, not to be negative, but I think males have demonstrated that they're not very good at the peaceful stewardship of our planet. And I think that women bring a balance and maturity to their view on all the subjects that keep communities healthy.
So let's turn the page, you say. Bring on the women. Sharon, thanks for your call. Ambassador Hunt, is it going to happen? I mean, it's been a long time since the planet was sort of matriarchally dominated or even half-half in power. I don't know when that was. Now they're not stones, they're nuclear weapons, Valerie says. And Sharon says it's time for women to kind of take charge. Progress, yes, but do you see it flipping?
The trend line is in the right direction. The question is, will it be fast enough? I think that's a great question because there are such huge dangers. And I am not looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. I can tell you that if we were able to get women in critical mass, you know, 30-40% in enough nations of the world, we would have a different world. I firmly believe that, whether or not we'll accomplish it, especially the U.S. leadership is important on that.
Are you all inspired when you see women taking up power in different countries, Betty?
I agree, but sometimes in a country like the Sudan, it is not just numbers that matter, because we still have a number of women who are not educated. We still have a very high level of illiteracy. So we need to have education so that women also get to the level that they can reason out in a similar manner like the men. Instead of men accepting that, yes, we want to bring women on the table and they just want to get women to fill the numbers, that is not good enough. We would like to have women who can actively participate, who can actively put reasons and positive actions in the country. So it is very important to have women in the on the table, sitting side by side in decision making with men. We would like also to see that women are educated to the level that they can participate in decision making as equal as men.
Well, it's been an honor to have all of you with us in this hour. Our time grows short, and I wish it didn't. Mishkat al-Mumin, our prayers with Iraq and men and women there. Tough situation. Americans watching especially closely. Betty Aguaro from Southern Sudan. We know what that part of the world has been through. Respect to you for your role in helping bring peace there. Thanks for being with us this hour. Sarita Giri from Nepal, with its own very tough story. We wish you luck on the road ahead. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This hour, thanks to all of you. And Ambassador Swanee Hunt, who's put this crew together. Thanks for your work. Thanks for being with us this hour.
You're very welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.